Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Recorded live in California, USA, it's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. The show that loves big, likes pop, and has fun. Now from the Wilson World Studios, here's Tom.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. Oddly enough, I would be Tom Wilson. Yeah, talking to you right now. Welcome to another episode. Hey, thanks for stopping by on this magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder and beverages. Well, I don't know why I just said that. I don't supply beverages on the podcast. Please supply your own beverages. And if you're driving, make it do whatever you want. But I do try to supply you with a magical sleigh ride of wonder as we glide across the glittering hills of our lives toward of the future. I don't know. Anyway, thanks for stopping by. I was talking to a friend. He said, you know, I'm listening to all the podcasts and enjoying them, and I'm getting great feedback. So thank you, everybody who's emailing me or commenting on iTunes or whatever. But my friend Jake, who will be on the podcast soon, I hope, he said, you know, I don't know if you know it, but there's a theme. There's a real theme to your podcast. And honestly, I really didn't know it because it is not false humility, people. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just kind of turning this recording thing on and just doing it and talking to people and, you know, and just having fun. But he said, there's a theme. I said, well, what is the theme? He said, you really like to talk to people who just think, you know, go out there and do it. Just put it together and don't listen to what anyone's saying. Just do what you want to do, you know, artistically and everything. And I said, wow, that's great. So this episode of the podcast is brought to you by getting out there and doing it. If you want to make a picture, buy some crayons. If you want to paint, then go out, get out there and buy the paints. And if you want to be an actor or a writer, hey, get a little basement somewhere, write the thing, and put on a show. You know, a friend of mine, Greg, I will also have my friend Greg on the podcast, but he was one of those guys that worked at Microsoft early on when everything, the tech boom was just beginning to happen. And I went to visit him there. I was working in Seattle, and I went to the campus of Microsoft, all these buildings and everything. But like any cheapo showbiz guy, I come by this room, and it's full of stacks of notebooks and pencils and pens and rulers. It's like a little, you know, stationery store. And I said, what is this thing? This is weird to have stacks of stuff. And he said, oh, yeah, you just take anything. You just take what you want. I said, again, cheapo showbiz guy, these notebooks are free? He goes, yeah, take whatever. They just want us to stay here. They just want us here working, you know, just whatever you do. There was a huge refrigerator like you would see at a convenience store, you know, and it was full of Coke and Diet Coke and every kind of drink. And he says, yeah, if you want anything to drink, just open it up and take something. And I was like, are you kidding me? Free, like pens and notebooks. But after that, you can have just a cold Coke whenever you want. He said, yeah, yeah. That's what it's like to help these creative tech people just keep working, keep them happy. If you need a notebook to write something down, hey, take a notebook because this thing is growing. And but then he noticed, you know, that what will always happen at the company. Well, not that it destroys everything, not that Lumberg comes and makes you do the cover on TPS reports, but the cafeteria starts charging a little more money, and the notebooks are sold in the company store, and you think, okay, the business guys are here, you know? So that's all right. That's okay, but the notebooks weren't free anymore. Well, I work often. I'm lucky enough to work often at Nickelodeon Studios over here in Burbank, California, on voiceover work and animation and stuff. I've talked to some of the people on the podcast, and I hope to do it more. And Nickelodeon still has that feeling. I know they're owned by a giant corporation now and everything, but Nickelodeon, well, now years ago, Nickelodeon was this burgeoning thing full of incredibly creative people. It still is. The Coke is still free at Nickelodeon. Now, Nickelodeon, they, early on, it was just this group of offices that people had, and it was a lot of artists and writers and people, this hotbed, the same kind of creative hotbed that I saw at Microsoft was at Nickelodeon, and that's where I met Mr. Lawrence. But I want to stress, I love the free Coke machine that's still at Nickelodeon. Anyway, everyone's very curious about Mr. Lawrence because on these on the Nickelodeon credits, especially on SpongeBob SquarePants, where Doug has been for many years now, it will have all of these names as writers or producers or whatever. And there's this guy and that guy and Mr. Lawrence, just MR period Lawrence. So everyone's like, who's Mr. Lawrence? And the guy's name is Doug Lawrence, and he's a great guy. A guy that I met several years ago, as I said, with and like so many people at Nickelodeon, with such a facility with both visual art, drawing and character invention and perspective and graphic design and all of those things that, that I love looking at so much. But on top of that, just being funny. Just being having the ability to write funny stuff and bring it across visually that was in a new and fresh and visionary way. So, hey, he has a lot to say about art and creativity, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Doug Lawrence, or should I say, Mr. Lawrence.
It's Big Pop Fun.
I wasn't that refined yet. I didn't have my chops yet.
We're here with Mr. Lawrence, and I was just talking stand-up because I really didn't know that you did stand-up. Did I know that?
I think you did, yeah. I did it for like three, four years, something like that. It was my first thing. It was the first thing I went out and said, I'm going to go have a career. This is how you do it. You know, go do stand-up in New York, you know, being from New Jersey.
Right.
Yeah.
So you grew up in New Jersey,
yeah.
And you were doing clubs in New Jersey, just disassembling
little
microphones?
Ones, yeah.
We didn't do it on mic, but you would open with a bit where you kind of were adjusting the microphone stand.
That's right.
Adjusting the microphone silently.
Silently,
and just kind of making sure everything's fine.
Right.
But then you ended up...
The joke was that I'd start, you know, it's everybody does it. Every comedian comes up and adjusts the mic for them. And so I would adjust the mic for them, for myself, and I'd just find, oh, geez, that's not really... And I wouldn't say anything, but you'd see me going, huh, that's not working. Uh-oh, okay, well, maybe I'll... And then it would just digress into being me being very angry and getting angry at it.
At the mic stand.
And then dismantling it completely and handing pieces to people in the front row.
So taking off the microphone clip.
Handing that out to somebody saying, hold this. Unscrewing the bass, the whole thing. And so one time I did
having it. Audience members hold like five different pieces of the microphone stand.
Yeah, just hanging
as
out
you're disassembling
like
the entire thing.
And then, oh, wait a minute, give me that back. And then I'm trying to put it back together with, you know, all thumbs. And it was just like a stupid, it was great. It was a dumb bit. And it you know, sometimes people loved it. And sometimes you'd hear, we get it.
There's always that guy.
Yeah, that was at the Comedy Store. I did that at the Comedy Store, I remember. And somebody was in the back. Oh, we get it. And I was like, no, this builds to something really great if you just shut up.
It was at the Comedy Store. It was probably a comic.
Comic or somebody who's just always at the Comedy Store.
Right.
That type.
Right.
So,
who didn't want to explore a different
of the past of comedy. Yeah.
But you know, and we won't harp on this, but you know, I think the power of that silence on stage.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Especially if they really are paying attention to you. And they kind of almost don't have a choice when you don't say anything. And because, especially when you don't say anything, you know, obviously, people don't, there can't be that dialogue. They almost can't heckle you. You know, they could say, we get it or something, but I mean, you haven't said anything yet, so there's nothing to pick apart yet. You know, you're just being physical on stage.
I think I've been surprised with how many people don't do something like that.
Yeah.
How everyone, I mean, fear just makes us fill the air with words.
I think.
Probably personally.
Got to keep talking.
And certainly
keep
on, on stage. Yeah. And then you think, well, personally, I have to talk a lot. And I'm the funny person who keeps kind of, I'm the one who gets in the funny little witty thing in conversations.
That's right.
So if I go on stage, I have to go up there, grab the microphone and go, hey, how you doing? Where are y'all from? Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah. You ever do this? And just go, you know.
That's right.
Whatever, or young people come up with, hey, how many people are drinking tonight? Whatever.
Yeah.
Anything to Estelle. And I'm talking to you. I'm just talking. I use words.
And I hate to say, this is the best review for that. We've heard it all before. So why do it? You know, we've heard that. So do something else. I mean, that's what I always say about all the stand-up I see. When I see somebody that really nails me, like you, where I just go, wow, that's really creative. That's what I'm searching for, you know. And also coming from being a comedy writer, somebody who does comedy as a for a living, you know, I've seen everything. You know, you've seen everything. You've seen the worst of it, and you've seen what you might consider to be the best of it.
Right.
So you want to, like, be part of it in a way where, you know, you want to, like, I want to like everything. I'm the guy who wants, you know, I want to laugh more than anybody in the room. But if it's the same old thing, I can't. And it's just, that's what happens. You know, you shut yourself off. You could be, that's great. But, I mean, you could be, you know, polite. But if it's not really that funny to me, and I'm not crying, laughing, and having fun, it's hard for me to enjoy it.
And I think well, myself included, everybody forgets that most people are out actually to have a good time, not to not have a good time.
That's
now
right,
we are
that's
going
right.
out, we're getting in the car, we're going out to a place in order to have a bad time.
That's right.
So they're sort of ready to be on your side if you're willing to help them,
yeah,
I think.
Absolutely.
Now, Tuesday night at some bar, when a guy's just there drinking, and they're going, okay, could everybody shut up and turn off the TVs? Because we got a guy who's going to come up. Well,
it's
then
really funny.
Yeah, then people are like, hey, I didn't come here for
this.
I came here to watch a basketball game and drink.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a tough crowd.
And we've all been in that situation.
But in a comedy club, people are like, well, let's go out and see something that's funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we really begin here in earnest, and we're probably a half hour in, but can I just ask how Mr. Lawrence, how did the Mr. Lawrence thing happen?
Oh,
was
the
that
name?
In order to be, because I think it's great, man. I think it's the like the best handle of a performer maybe I've ever heard.
Really?
Yeah.
You really like it. You really do like it.
Because people will talk to me.
Because, you know, we have friends who are, you know, either comedians or we write comedy. We always assume the other person is, you know, is being ironic. So.
Oh, of course. No, I'm not being ironic.
Say, I really love that. You go, really? No, but thank you. I appreciate that.
I do. Yeah. I do because it lends mystery when your name is on credits.
That's right.
And, you know, somebody will be talking to me about SpongeBob or whatever, and the person that sticks in their mind is Mr. Lawrence.
Yeah. No, it's more synonymous. I've been told my name's sort of more synonymous with the show than a lot of the people who should be more synonymous.
So
with
there
it.
Is that. Who is Mr. Lawrence? What's that deal?
Yeah, that's like I got to directly take that as me ripping off from Dr. Seuss. I mean, it was sort of like I love Dr. Seuss. I was making comic strips in college. Pardon me. And I started to put together, I guess, you know, just trying to figure out it wasn't necessarily like, let's come up with a new crazy name. It was more like, what looks good when I sign it?
Oh, sure.
How does the signature look right?
Oh, visibly on
the comic strip. How does that look? And that led me to, Doug Lawrence is just, it's kind of bland. My Doug is a sort of a bland name, Douglas. I was almost Mr. Douglas, but then I kept thinking of Fred McMurray.
Yeah,
so that was out, and I just went, no, Mr. Douglas, that sounds weird. So my father's name is Lawrence, his first name, it's a middle name. So I just started signing it Mr., and it looked cool. And at the time, I was in central New Jersey near Rutgers talking about, you know, in high school saying, I'm going to Hollywood. You know, I'm going to go out and make cartoons and make films. I had this whole plan figured out, sort of what I wanted to do in high school. And so it was sort of like I talked about it all the time. So friends used to call me Mr. Lawrence sometimes as a joke, as to mock me.
You know,
Mr. Lawrence has to go to Hollywood. You know, so it was like this it was a partial joke already. So when I thought of it, I went, oh, yeah, that's funny to me because my friends would sign birthday cards to me with, you know, to Mr. Lawrence. And So it evolved out of that. It was sort of like, it's like, oh, that might be funny. And then when I got to my first job on Rocco's Modern Life as a voiceover actor playing Filbert, that was like, I went to SAG. I was Taft Hartley for a while, and then I went to SAG, and then
the Screen Actors the Guild, Screen Actors Guild, you have to have a different name than everyone else in the union.
And there's a Doug Lawrence already, who's I think he's a professional clarinet player, but he's been on camera. So even though he's not really an actor, it doesn't matter. So I immediately in my head I just went, well, Mr. Lawrence, I guess, you know. So but you can't use abbreviations. So in SAG. Oh, on my card, it's M-I-S-T-E-R. I just spell it.
Oh, okay.
So, but although I never spell it that way, except on legal things.
How did Mr. T get away with that?
I don't know. I don't think anybody questioned Mr. T.
Well, why would someone?
You get pounded.
He could come up in
I'm not gonna
red
hurt
and black van and do things with George Papard. Yeah. I don't know.
I wanted to let you know that, first of all, thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure.
So, because I love talking to you anyway. So this is just with microphones.
Thanks, but yeah, we're doing it.
This
look at this.
The same thing I like doing.
We're doing
anyway.
It with microphones in your guest house office thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I appreciate that, and I wanted to tell you right up front that if you say anything that that I have a problem with or anything untoward, I'm walking. This interview's over. And
really?
And yeah, because. And it'll be just like Charlton Heston did to Michael Moore. Did you see that? Did you ever see
Charlton Heston walk out?
Yeah, it's fantastic because Michael Moore is interviewing Charlton Heston at his house, in Charlton Heston's house, in a little room like this.
Yeah,
and he says something he doesn't like, and at one point he just stands up and he goes, "This interview is over," and he walks for the. He walks out of his house. He walks
out of his own house.
Yeah, he walks out of his own house and then flees to another part of his house. And I've never seen that ever. I think that's the greatest walkout I've ever seen. I'm walking out of my own house.
So since we're at your house now, you walk out, if I say something untoward, you're going to walk to a different part of your house?
I'm just going to walk to a different section of my house. Right.
Wow.
Isn't that awesome?
All right,
That's so Hollywood.
That's what I have never done.
And only
an
Charlton Heston would do that. Usually you'd say, this interview is over. Get out of my house.
Well, yeah.
He just walked out. So that'll be the name of this interview. This interview is over. Get out of my house.
I think I met Charlton Heston. He was a very nice man.
I bet he was.
Very nice man.
Oh, no. I'm saying I'm just an observer. Yeah. I'm not making any judgments. It was funny. No.
We were in a restaurant and he didn't leave at all.
No, he just
stood up and said, I'm standing now until you leave.
Now. Yeah.
Coming from the middle of what town in New Jersey did you grow up in?
East Brunswick.
Oh, so up north a little bit.
Up north a little bit. Just over from New Brunswick, a couple miles away where Rutgers is. That's my landmark.
What did your dad do?
My dad owns and it's a family business we've had since my grandfather, air conditioning and heating.
So your dad's in air conditioning and heating.
Absolutely.
Your mom, did she work?
My mom did a lot of jobs. Like she was always trying to start a career of some kind. So she was always going into New York to do things. She was a salesman for a company that sold headshots of famous people. You could buy a great headshot of Deborah Harry.
Right, right.
Back when she was, when that was something people wanted. No offense to Deborah Harry.
I'm just saying,
when she was a hot commodity, that's what one of the things she was going and doing. She was a chiropractor's assistant. She was a lot of different things, my mother. She's always been. She's a people person, my mother.
Yes. Photographically or even live.
Yes.
With their spine.
Absolutely. And my dad is too, but like I said, the family business was something that was, sort of rounded out how I look at things now, because I grew up being part of the family business, answering the phones at times, putting ductwork together, getting into crawl spaces because I was tiny, I could get through stuff, and just be one of those, I was part of the family business, and it was fun because they were all, my family's very sarcastic and funny. And they like to joke on each other and play little pranks and stuff. So it was always fun. It was the brothers. It was like four brothers that were in the business. So it was just when I went on the jobs, I actually, as a kid, couldn't wait to go out on jobs with my dad and the family, because it was always going to be funny. So it was great.
So that's the beginning of comedy.
For me.
Is you and your dad and your brothers.
Absolutely. And his brothers.
Out fixing duck. Oh, your dad's brothers.
My dad's brothers.
So your
yeah.
uncles.
Yeah, I have a sister, but she never really was part. She answered the phone sometimes, but she was never really indoctrinated into doing actual physical labor.
So all the guys are out in a van.
Yeah, that's right.
Going to houses in New Jersey.
Absolutely.
With little Doug.
Yeah.
Just having a ball.
Having a ball.
Just climbing up in
and
the
And wherever
duck
I went, they gave me candy or gave me something. Oh, isn't it sweet? He's with his father.
So all of this duct work and everything, the family business, but you say in the middle of high school, you were going to Hollywood and everything. What is the seed of that? What is the seed of, Dad, I don't think that I'm working the duct work.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure everybody was expecting that's what I would do. And they were like going, hey, man, you've got a failsafe. Here it is.
Right.
It's here for you. You don't have to do anything. You could just follow along. You know how this stuff works now. You've done it already. It wasn't like I was so against that. It was more like I was always drawing. And drawing was the gateway, drug to everything else. You know, it was sort of like that led me to performing, that led me to writing anything creative, that led to everything else. So
you were just sort of writing comic strips?
Yeah, writing little comic strips as probably, I'd say, I started drawing, my mom will tell you, I started drawing at like 4, and then it just got relentless after that. It became a obsession of mine. Like, I was always drawing, like in a really, really weird kind of, why isn't he playing with the other kids? Oh, he's drawing. All right, leave him alone. You know, that kind of thing. But then I found as soon as I started playing with kids, I started directing them. I was immediately like taking the kids and saying, hey, okay, this is what we're doing today. We're doing the Wizard of Id comic strip. Are you familiar with it? Okay, you're playing the guy on the rack. You're playing, the prince. You're playing this. And I would tell them their lines.
From the comic strip,
from the Sunday
paper.
That I had. And I would just say, okay, that's what we're doing today. Okay. Action. You know, it was like I did that out on the playground, out on places, and kids who just looked at it as something odd and something, okay, that's something to do. I'd grab those people. I'd grab whoever, ever misfit kid that just wanted to like do something and not just play sports or do whatever else I was doing that. And all of a sudden I'm out there on the playground and I'm going in grade school from room to room performing these little plays like at Christmas time. They would go, oh, does Doug have a little play for us this Christmas? And I would go and do something. You know, I would just go and do something.
You would sort of write them out and act it out in the classroom.
Yeah, we did Star Wars. We did The Great Race. Remember the Jack Lemmon?
One of my favorite
movies of all time, right? And most of the kids didn't know The Great Race because my family loved it. So I knew it.
That is so funny, Doug. My family and my kids now love The Great Race.
That's
and if anybody's listening and you haven't seen it, watch The Great Race. One of the greatest comedy moments of all time is
and one of the great 3-hour extravaganza.
Oh my gosh!
You know, I think I love Mad World a lot, but I think Great Race is just a little.
Oh,
bit
I think
better.
So too.
Yeah, because the craftsmanship of the comedy is
just
amazing.
Jack Lemmon as Professor Fate staring into a little puppy licking his face and saying.
Right.
I hate you. it's a brilliant. So you would act things like that out.
Oh, yeah. And I just thought, you're the great Leslie, you're Professor Fate, you're Peter Falk. You know, I just go down the list and say who you are. And I'd act it out for them, say, this is who you are. But I used to also do, I knew a couple of Bill Cosby bits by heart because I'd listen to them over and over. So then I'd go and do that. At recess, when we would get rained in or snowed in, they'd ask if anybody wanted to play show and tell or do this or do that. And I'd always have that on my that was part of something I did. And kids would ask for it. You know, it was like, could you do Revenge, that old, that bit? And they didn't even know it was Bill Cosby.
Oh, sure, yeah.
They just assumed it was me making it up.
Right.
But I just knew it. And so to be up – so that's what started the performance thing because it's always been a tug of war for me of doing something that's really an introverted art, like doing, like you do, painting and doing, drawing of any kind, which is very much you need to be super obsessed, focused with yourself in a room locked away and then doing something that's actually completely extroverted where you're in front of a big crowd doing something.
Isn't that interesting? That really is the tightrope walk, isn't it?
Yeah.
between something that's so introverted and so extroverted.
Yeah.
Both at the same time.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
And thinking about today, which one am I going to do? Or which one, which one do I need to do?
That's right.
You know, because
right.
I have a show to do today.
That's right.
And tomorrow I'm going to finish that painting or whatever.
That's right.
So it's really
and you have to balance that.
It's really
time.
An emotional, psychological whiplash.
And you have to get into that space. I mean, people don't always realize when you're doing anything creative, especially if you do a kind that's introverted, where you have to be alone. You can't just sit down and type or just start painting. You have to find it. You have to like search yourself.
You I've spent most of my life trying wandering. To convince people that when I'm pacing around just muttering,
right, muttering.
And it looks like I'm doing nothing. I'm actually working very
hard. Working very hard.
Because the motor is just spinning.
Yeah. And that's the process. You have to do that. You can't get to the mountain. You have to climb that mountain before you get there. And it's sort of like you can't be creative until all your ducks are sort of creatively in a row. You can't do anything.
So
kind of funny.
like me in the middle of high school, you're just kind of deciding.
Right. That's right.
That this is a direction you're going to take.
Yeah.
No air conditioning. I'm going to go and I'm going to, what you were ready to do art or were you going for animation?
Well, I fell in love with animation. Comic strips and comic books were back and forth. For me, I couldn't decide what I liked the most growing up as in grade school throughout that time. But then Star Wars happened, and Star Wars made me look at film. I didn't care about film that much until Star Wars. And then I went, oh, wow, film is cool. And then I discovered Alfred Hitchcock, and I discovered, you know, later there was different ones, but just and more of the Disney features and stuff. But then that led me to Bugs Bunny, which I'd already known and loved and liked as a kid. But as early teens, that became the thing I cared about the most was Bugs Bunny short cartoons. I got so obsessive with it. I could tell you all the things about it. Like somebody knows baseball scores and stats, which I know nothing about, but I know a lot about short cartoons and all that stuff because I became a student of it when I was 13, 14.
Just breaking it down shot by shot.
Knowing what animators, that's that animator. When he pops up, I can tell who that is. I had to do research because there was really no, like there is now, which everybody, you could look up stuff. There was no internet, so you couldn't just go find stuff. You had to go to a library and really look it up and see, oh, that's... something that I'm interested in. Let me find it out. So then I'd find little out of the way magazines where animators had done interviews and things like that. And I found, and then so I knew who Friz Freleng was and Chuck Jones and Tex Avery. I knew and Bob Clampett. I knew all these guys, and I was a big fan of them. Nobody else in school really cared. I was at that age where kids aren't really watching the short cartoons anymore. So it was a nerdy thing to do, and it was something that was not necessarily something I wanted everybody to know I was doing. I kind of kept that hidden, but that was my secret obsession, was Bugs Bunny. So it became a thing where I just kept going towards that and trying to make my own cartoons and my own stuff. And my family at that time just thought it was something cool that I did, and they thought it was fun. They were always supporting me to do it. They never really thought I was going to take it seriously and say I want a career out of this.
Doug likes cartoons.
Doug likes cartoons. He likes to draw cartoons.
Yeah.
He happens to be, he's won awards for it. He's pretty good at this. I'd win local awards for things at the state fair and school, stuff like that. And then some kind of, like I said, I'd always liked to perform, but I never thought about doing it. And then it sort of overlapped all of a sudden where I wanted to make, where video cameras were really available and my family had one. So all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, maybe I should film something. Maybe I should pick up the camera. And then that became the other split, other side of me. This obsession was just making short films and making little pieces with myself, doing funny things with my friends, trying to get my family into it and do that kind of stuff.
Were you doing that in high school?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you graduate there. What did you go to school after high school, or did you just dive in?
I went to like a trade school for drawing. I met Disney animators, and I met
was that out here
artists. No, in New Jersey.
Is that that place, that hotbed of guys that are out
the
here now?
School? Is that the Kubert School? Yeah.
So many guys went to that place.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that was one of the places that. I mean, that was the first place where I didn't think the administration was the greatest, but the fact that you were now in a pool with other guys who thought the way you did.
Isn't that the most important thing?
Like that in school that thought the way I did at all until I got to that little school.
I mean, schools like that, though, it's I mean, there's some teaching that's useful, but most of it is just this hotbed, a bubbling cauldron of young people who are going after it.
Yeah. And finally said, oh, I'm not insane, or I'm not weird, or I'm not, you know, people are pointing at me and telling me, what are you doing, you know, in at home, at school, you know, and here's a bunch of people who just all say, no, we are this. This is what we do. You know, all of a sudden I met older, a little slightly older people who were more, you know, who were more worldly about being an artist. Because you, when you're being an artist, it's when that first happens to you, where you realize that that's what you are and that's what you're going to do. You seem really weird to everybody.
Well, sure.
At that age specifically. And you seem like also like you're just yammering. Like you're just saying, yeah, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And everybody,
well, because
nobody
as
believes
you, know,
you really.
I'm from Philadelphia, you're from New Jersey. You can't, how do you, you can't make a living at that, Doug. Are you out of your mind?
That's right.
Look, kid, you're very good at the drawing and everything.
You've made
very funny little videos.
Yeah.
But you got to, you need to buy food and things.
Right,
you
that's
know?
Right. And I just, I my feeling at that time was, well, yeah, but people do it for a living. So that's who I am. I'm going to be doing what they do. But they're them. That's them. That's not – you got to look at it from the standpoint of – I mean, I know my family was very – were worried for me. Not just that they didn't want me to go somewhere else and do something else away from the family business. It was more – there is my welfare. They wanted to make sure I didn't get hurt or I didn't get disappointed too much and then, you know, end up in the gutter somewhere, I guess. But I just felt like my thing was, well, there's no option for me. And that's the thing we always talk about. You know, if you have to do this, you know when you have to do this. You know at a certain point, that's the way it is. I have to do this. It might be wrong. It might be bad for me. It might be whatever it is. But I have no choice. This has been decided already somehow in my genetics. I don't know what it is, but I have to do it. And that's the difference between whether you should do it or not. It's like if you have to, you have no choice. You really don't have a choice. But if you don't have to, and you're sort of like, eh, maybe I'll do that. You know, there's a lot of heartache in there. So you know, I always tell people if you're not really into it, probably shouldn't get in the show business because it's just harsh and it's horrible. But if you're plowing through because you love it so much. You can take all the good with the bad.
Right. And you can't ultimately, fine. And you can't not do it.
No, you absolutely cannot.
You just have to. There's no really decision to be made. Should I or shouldn't I?
No, and I tried to explain that, but there was no, you know, that was deaf ears. There was no way they were going to listen to me on that level. In fact, even some friends were like, okay, Doug, but what are you going to do really? And I'd say, well, I'm not going to be here soon. That's the thing. I'm going to be gone soon. I'm going to be in L.A., okay, whatever you say, man. You know, it was like that kind of a thing. Not everybody. That, you know, a lot of my friends supported me. And then other ones were just like, whatever, good luck. And I had friends that came out here before I did while I was doing my, you know, while I was at the Kubert School. I had friends who jumped ahead who were, you know, there was like one who wanted to be a makeup artist. There was one who wanted to be a writer who came out here looking for work. And came back before, you know, moved back home. Came out here, moved back home before I went out. And just said, don't do it, man. Don't do it. It's brutal out there. And when there's no work, there's no work. And everything costs too much. It was like this whole, you know, telling you all the stuff that you didn't want to hear, you know, at, you know, 19 years old, you know, 20 years old. You don't want to hear any of this stuff. You're like, you're just very, very scared by... You know, because you don't hear us. But in back of my head, I just kept saying, yeah, but that's you. That's not me.
But isn't that, that's confidence.
I'm supposed to do this, you know.
And you had confidence in your ability, I'm assuming. Yeah, you said, well, I'm good at this.
And I was full of it, too. But we all are. You have to be full of it. You know, you have to have that ego. You have to have that ballast, that ridiculous pomposity that pushes you through to say, hey, I'm looking for a job. You know, you have you have to have that.
I think you need so much of that.
Because of all
the dry times, you're going to need a lot of rocket fuel to begin with.
Right, a lot of power.
To just carry you through.
Yeah, and that's what pushes you through. If you keep doing it, then you don't think about it. You know, you just keep going, well, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
There is no choice. And I was, you know, I mean, more or less I was right. I mean, my family was, I've been lucky that I've been working steady for a long time. And so, you know, I rarely had time. I've had time off, but usually because I take it off. I've worked all the time pretty much for years. So it's, and my family was skeptical at all of it, even when I was leaving. Like, I don't know, he'll probably be back. You know, I'm not sure what's going on with him. But then they saw my name on Ren and Stimpy, and then that was it.
Huh.
That was the end of it. Oh,
when
you're
first
on TV.
Came out here.
I saw your name on TV, so you're on. So it's,
well, sure,
it's great now. You're
did
fine.
Did you hook up with a show early on when you were out here?
Yeah, I got on. Well, I got on. I was on Film Roman was the first place to give me work,
mm-hmm.
And right after that, it was like, so I was there for a while.
Film Roman is a production company here that's produced many
The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Does the life. So they did a movie, the Tom and Jerry movie, which is not memorable and is not something I would recommend for people to see. My name's not even on it, even though I animated on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I left early and they forgot to put my name on the credits. So which was fine. So I left early. I went to Ren and Stimpy, which was my big goal at that time, because there was really nothing happening in animation except for the old stuff I was watching that I thought was awesome. And my family was even telling me then, you know, they don't make that anymore. They don't do that kind of animation. What you like to do, they don't do that. So where are you going? You know, even if you go out there, they don't do this. And
So early on, you got hooked in with Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah, yeah. But that's because Roger Rabbit had happened in 1988, and I just went, no, I knew it. I didn't say this, but I knew there was a feeling inside me that said, it's going to change soon. People are going to appreciate animation more after that movie. And I thought that before that movie. But after that movie, I went, I'm right. This is correct. This is going to happen. And then the Disney store, Warner Brothers store, all these things started to pop up, and everyone's buying animation memorabilia again. And I said, oh, okay, I think this is correct. And within a couple of years after I was thinking that, the boom in Hollywood started for brand new cartoons, which started with Nickelodeon and, you know, their Ren and Stimpy and Rugrats and those shows that they had.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and what did you do on Ren and Stimpy?
I was an animator,
uh-huh.
Or a keyframe layout, which is basically on that show is you know, as close as you get to animation.
Yeah, for people who don't know, what is keyframe layout? What do you do?
you pose it out. Mm-hmm. So that the extreme poses are all posed out by you of what happens in the scene.
And then someone else takes it from Ren's surprised look into the beginning of him running away, let's say.
Yeah, I'll put all the keyframes poses that need to be that you need to follow. It's like a blueprint, more or less, of what it's really going to look like. And then someone needs – and then overseas they fill in the middle, mm-hmm. the middle parts from – you know, point A to point B, in between point A and point B. And that's how I started. Like I said, I started as an animator, but I quickly saw that there was a sort of a mentality in a good way, and a sort of, you know, like I knew I wasn't a sculptor. I tried that and I was mm-hmm. like, this isn't for me. I can tell that I don't have the temperament for this. Animation, being an animator, is kind of similar temperament to being like a sculptor or being you know, somebody who does, you know, paintings. I just think it's another way. It's something that just didn't appeal to me. I liked being a little more loose. And so I found myself wanting to be a guy, an idea guy, somebody who could tell stories and tell jokes and make up gag ideas. And so that came out pretty quick after that. It was sort of like, oh, I can try this. You know, this is another way to go. I kind of like that. I like being the guy who comes up with the stuff.
And how do you do that? Do you start just pitching jokes on Ren and Stimpy or pitching little story ideas or something?
That's the first thing I did. I mean, I was already doing that a little bit with friends. We were coming up with ideas for shows and things like that and making up little storyboards that we would act out and do voices for and stuff like that. But when I got to Ren and Stimpy, I was hired as hired as the layout guy. And then I said, well, I got to work my way up here, you know, because, you know, I want to there's other things I want to do, and I want to do, you know, I want to be more part of the writing end. So I started to submit that kind of stuff to John Kay and the others there, and Vincent Waller and Rich Purcell and some of the other guys. And they saw that I had potential to do it, and so they kind of encouraged me to keep doing it. But I wasn't, you know, we were already in the middle of a season of the show. I wasn't going to be a writer yet on the show. And then the bottom fell out of that show. The show got not canceled, but the show got taken away from the creator. And that ended up being sort of the end of me doing it on that show. But then I was able to, right after that, my time off, I spent a lot of time doing, I realized, okay, I have to really do this if I want to do this. So I wrote a lot of storyboards of my own ideas, little cartoon ideas with characters I created. And
this would be like, what, a little five-minute vignette?
Yeah,
or shorter vignettes. Than that?
Little vignettes, yeah, of character stuff. And I would use those to go around and try to get work. And that's what I found, is that people were, I was of the mind of all the old stuff I grew up with, and I knew how they made that stuff, because I had researched it and found out how that stuff went down. So I was copying those guys. So when I walked into places, they were like, you're exactly what we want. You do what we want to do. It was like I was a specialist all of a sudden. But the thing is, I'd been doing it since I was 14.
From breaking down Bugs Bunny.
Right.
When you were 13.
And freeze framing it every frame and deciding how this all happens, you know, or assuming how it all happens, and then finding information that corroborated that that theory.
Then sort of getting into Ren and Stimpy, and it's this sort of modernist animation sensibility.
Yeah, it was my, it felt like today. It didn't feel like,
Today, but you could also include yesterday's animation.
Well, I was on board, because I realized that we weren't going to make cartoons exactly like the old ones, because that was a different time period. And so that's why Ren and Stimpy was such a revelation for the industry and for me, because I knew that this was not the past. I knew that this was built on the past, and it had all the, you know, it had all the the bells and whistles of the past, and it was caring about the drawing, you know, a lot. I mean, the drawing mattered on that show a lot, and that was the greatest place for me to go from working with like a Disney animator over at the Kubert School, Milt Neal, to all of a sudden working in this group with John Kay and these other guys, Bob Camp and Jim Smith, who were these guys who had been working in the industry for a while at that point. And had their own things, and they grew up on, and they loved the same stuff I love. So we were all in this, it was all the same sandbox. We were all just very, very happy to be around others that wanted to do this. So it was sort of like going to college again, all over again, and now you're here. And so that ended up being a very enriching experience, not only as an artist, but just as, you know, as usual, being around other people who are, you know, in most cases better than you are, but who love all the same stuff you do and are looking for the same goal you are, you know? So you're like, wow, okay. This is a real thing. This is a real lifestyle. It's not just something I was dreaming of.
Affirming a path that you've been on since you were a kid, and saying, hey, Doug, you're not crazy.
Right.
This is good and worthwhile, and you're doing good stuff and you're good at it. So let's continue with that.
So that was the first show I'm on is a hit show, you know, first show. 'Cause it was just starting to get attention when I joined it. So then all of a sudden, I'm signing stuff. I'm at places signing stuff. You know,
Mr. Lawrence.
This 20-year-old kid signing stuff at the stores and stuff. And it's like, wow, how did that happen? And so that became the front of it. You know, for me, I was like, all right, well, I got where I wanted to get here. So now I have to do what I really want to do, which is to be the guy who writes and draws this stuff. And, you know, and I also still wanted to do voices. You know, I wanted to be Mel Blanc and Chuck Jones. And, you know, I wanted to be everything. You know, everything I loved, I wanted to do all of it. And that led to, like I said, doing my own storyboards after Ren and Stimpy went off for me was Rocko's Modern Life. And that led into me doing kind of everything, getting to really have a crash course in here's how you do it, because I got to do everything. I got to storyboard and direct. I got to direct voice sessions. I got to be a voiceover actor. You know, I got to design a lot of stuff. We learned about editing from that show. It was just like a college. It was like a real college for people who wanted to do funny cartoons.
How long did Rocko's Modern Life run?
I think it was 4 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So and it's actually, it's like I said, it got a little bit of attention. Critics liked it when it came out, but people were indifferent to it one way or the other. It wasn't a big thing. And then I find out more over time that people are big fans of it, you know. And surprisingly, people are fans of it. Like Scarlett Johansson, when we did the movie, when we did the SpongeBob movie,
yeah.
She started, her assistant came over to me and told me that. She said, "Did you do Rocko's Modern Life?" She goes, "That's Scarlett's favorite show." So I went over and talked to her, and she said, you know, because we were talking anyway, and I said, "Rocko's your favorite show?" Because she goes, "Yeah, did you do that?" I said, "Yeah, I directed and wrote that show." Because she goes, "Wow, that's my favorite show." I said, "Who's your favorite character?" And, you know, unsolicited, didn't say anything. She goes, "Filbert was my favorite character who I played." So I said, I'm nauseous. And she blushes, and then I blush because she blushed. It was just really funny. It was like, that's my big celebrity moment was, uh-huh. was making Scarlett Johansson blush because I did Filbert. She goes, "Yep, that's him." So she was fun.
And when, after Rocko's Modern Life, like you, so you're over.
Yeah.
You're becoming one of the, you know, not Frizz Freeling, but you're becoming in the modern animation world.
I'm one of those guys. Right, right.
People want Mr. Lawrence's autograph, and the people new kids who are into that animation.
Yeah, yeah. If they're into Rocko, if they're into Ren and Stimpy, I was
still signing stuff.
Mr.
Lawrence
is. Yeah, they knew who I was. Yeah. Yeah. But I didn't use my name, Mr. Lawrence, until Rocko.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I didn't have to. I was just an artist on a show. So it was Doug Lawrence up until the SAG thing happened. And then that turned into, where I wanted to use it. And then when I started using it full time was SpongeBob. That's where I just went, I'm going to make a decision here. I'm just going to be Mr. Lawrence from now on. Because, like you said, I think it's mysterious. And most people would say they remembered it because it's weird and because it's odd and it's off-putting. And you're like, who's that guy? What pompous moron calls himself Mr. Lawrence?
Dude, I love it, man. I love it.
It's a joke. And then when you meet people, especially when I was in my 20s, they'd go, "You're 12 years old. You're not Mr. Lawrence." You know, it was a real joke that way. And I still think it works. It still works now. Eventually, it'll just be, you know, I'll look like, you know, I don't know what, Cesar Romero. But
I always thought, you know, I should have gone with whatever, Thunderbolt Johansson. I said, you know, those people who come here and they name their soam, especially in stand-up comedy.
Absolutely.
You know, hi, what's your name? Nice to meet you. You're performing tonight? Yeah, I'm, you know, Binky Squidge. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, Wayno Drano.
Exactly. Wayno Drano, whatever. Everything is bizarre, kooky man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Flip Flingy. It's just whatever sound you make. That's my name.
That's it.
So I never went with, well, I couldn't go with Mr. Wilson because it's, you know, the Dennis the Menace thing.
Mm-mm.
But there were, when you're a kid, those things like what name should I go by?
Yeah.
And I think that sort of, I don't want to say antisocial, but mm-hmm. there was this, when I was 19 and you're thinking about what name, there was a strong stripe in me that's going like, look, that's my name, man. You don't want to remember it, don't remember it. I don't care.
Right, right.
I'm, you know, whatever. I'll get on stage. I'm, you know.
Whatever.
If you don't remember it, then I should probably quit.
That's right.
So whatever. Right, remember it, don't remember it. Thinking back, I definitely should have gone with, you know, Thunderbolt Williamson and his power pack.
Billy
Atomic
Excitement.
Billy Excitement would be good.
Because, I mean, that's another thing. Another reason Mr. Lawrence started to stick more, I guess, over time was that Mr. wasn't the first thing that happened. Lawrence, my real name's Osowski.
Oh,
which is a hard, really, really hardcore Polish name.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I did stand-up, when I went to do stand-up, nobody, even if I told them ahead of time, here's how you say it,
yeah,
never got it right. So I'd go, well, I'd rather you'd remember at least what the guy says when he introduces me than it be incoherent where you can't understand what the hell the guy said. So I just immediately said, well, I'll just use my middle name. So that started. I was Doug Lawrence before I was Mr. Lawrence. So I've changed my name legally to Lawrence.
So your legal name now is Doug Lawrence.
Is Doug Lawrence, yeah.
And your dad back in air conditioning, says Osowski Air Conditioning?
No, it's Hanko. They actually have my grandfather who founded the business, name was Hank.
Okay.
So they called it Hanko. So,
uh-huh.
so he's, it's like Genko, just like
of course, the olive Godfather. Oil importers.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, and since your family's in air conditioning ducts in East Brunswick, New Jersey, They probably know each other.
That's right, right.
They're probably related in some way.
Yeah, Polish mafia.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
So when SpongeBob started, were you instrumental in that? Was Plankton an early character there?
Yeah, he was part of the – I mean, Steve had his – here's the thing. When we were making Rocco, we were all pals, you know, really close on that show because we were making it every day together. We were in the oven, you know.
Sure.
Baking all the goods.
Yeah, and you're talking about Steven Hillenburg.
Steven Hillenburg, also Robert Skull, who's the creator of Bubble Guppies, Dan Povemeyer and Swampy Marsh, your creators of Phineas and Ferb. You know, there was like you said, a hot, bubbling hotbed of talent. There was a lot. It was a show that people now look at and say, "Wow, how did that happen?" But it was just because it was the right time. It just mm-hmm. there was enough great people around at that time who sort of migrated here all at the same time. Most people were from San Francisco, or they were from the East Coast. Almost everybody came from those two places mm-hmm. to do the cartoons. So we became Steve and I saw eye to eye on how to do things in comedy and what we thought our influences were. We both love Bugs Bunny and we both love Monty Python. So it was sort of like that was our thing, and we got together. And Mark O'Hare, I'm leaving out, is another great guy, and Tim Borglund and Jeff Myers, two other guys. There wasn't that many. That's the group, and a couple of writers. There's Martin Olson, who I think you know too, mm-hmm. And we saw things a certain way, and we were dealing with a guy who had his own show, you know, creator Joe Murray. And sometimes we didn't see eye to eye with him. You know, sometimes we'd say, well, we want to do this. This is weird and crazier than what you're thinking. We want to do this. And most of the time he let us do what we wanted to do. But there were things we kept putting in our back pocket saying, okay, when we get our show, though, we're doing this. And SpongeBob became that show. It basically was we were all trying to get shows going. But that one happened. And
I remember that because Nickelodeon was in a place where they were putting out a lot of those kind of seemed like 5-minute vignettes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was doing a little voiceover things here and there, but people would call me in to, hey, could you do Mean Fish 2 and
That's
this
right.
thing? It's
That's
about
right.
whatever.
That's right.
It's about an armadillo who plays the accordion. Okay, fine.
I'm this guy now.
And
then
it was some. It's a sponge.
Yeah.
With square, he's got pants, and so we call him SpongeBob.
But there was no,
pants.
Like I said, it could have just as well that show that we all had shows that were vying for trying to get attention. It was just trying to get it under the door, and Steve was able to get that show under the door because they needed him at a certain point because he was the guy who took over Rocco when Joe Murray left at the last season. So he sort of cornered the studio by saying, look, yeah, I'll take over this show. And it was mostly because all of the rest of us were doing other things. We were all like, everybody was a personality. Everybody had their things they were trying to do. And Steve said, well, I have this one show I'm working on. I'm trying to put it together, but I need somebody to do it. So maybe, I mean, he was saying, I remember us having, you know, conversations here and there about it. So maybe if I ingratiate myself and do a season of the show as a producer for them, I can make them do my pilot at least. And so they did the pilot. I know that for the most part, no one was into it.
The SpongeBob pilot.
The studio itself was not like, oh, this is the greatest thing we've ever seen. But it tested great. So that was the thing where, all right, this tested great. So let's get behind this one because back then that meant something. Testing, they still do testing, but I don't think it means anything like it used to. And it really meant something then. And so they said, all right, let's try it. And I think they really thought we were – I'm pretty sure the studio thought we were going to be done after a season after the two seasons. That was the standard thing was they'd make two seasons of a show.
And which is how many episodes in animation?
I guess that's like two seasons. I guess one season's like 40-something episodes. Mm-hmm. Once they start making orders, the order's bigger. It's like 52 episodes. Mm-hmm. And that means 52, you know it's 52, but it's whatever that comes out to. I'm not good at math.
Right. Neither am I. I just was getting
it's
scared.
It's half of that. You know, it's whatever it is, 20-something episodes. So
it's so funny that two of us—
11 minutes that make up a half hour.
Two sort of artsy guys who actually looked at each other was half of 52.
Really? I was searching. I was
hoping
you would know.
We stare each other in the eyes. And we may have to stop the recording here and hug it out.
Yeah.
Because 52.
And
like,
I have to get my calculator out.
Let's say, I think 52,
let's have a 52.
I ran out of toes. So they did a bunch of them because the pilot just tested well.
The pilot tested well, and they didn't understand why. They didn't get it. We were hearing the worst things from people at parties and stuff about how annoying the character was, how obnoxious the show was. Those guys think they're funny, and they aren't, you know, and that kind of thing. And we just went, well, we think it's funny to us, and self-indulgent came up all the time, you know, that sort of thing. But that kind of thing came up during Ren and Stimpy. So I would just always say, and I was the only one who was from Ren and Stimpy in that group, and I'd say, that's it happened when we were on Ren and Stimpy. You know, screw that. Don't worry about it.
Right.
You know, forget it. And so we plowed through, and then all of a sudden, second season premiere was huge ratings.
Kablooey.
Yeah. And that's when everyone realized, oh, there's kids, not only kids watching this, adults are watching it, and college kids are watching this. And that's when we had them again. That's when, as far as me being at Ren and Stimpy and knowing we had a certain
thing. I think Ren and Stimpy was a big show, but I don't think there has been a show since Looney Tunes, since the Bugs Bunny that you were talking about, that came out and both adults and it was working on absolutely two levels.
That's right.
That adults were actually loving it and kids were loving it.
Yeah.
That was a very unusual thing to be, that you started to feel the SpongeBob tsunami building, where a lot of people really like this.
And the funny thing was, too, is that a lot of it came out of the sensibility of it and the tone, because Rocco has a very, if you watch Rocco, Rocco's very similar to SpongeBob. It's almost the gang, you know, it's the springboard for SpongeBob almost. Mm-hmm. I don't think SpongeBob would have been quite the same thing had Rocco not happened. And so we went through that. So when we went to the next, you know, we got to SpongeBob, it was sort of, like I said, all the stuff we wanted to do, like the live action cutaways that are ridiculous, mm-hmm. and, you know, Patchy the Pirate, you know, those live action pieces, you know, the Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy stuff, you know, just all the little extra things that came up. Were things that were sort of like, we were already wanting the show to be a little more non sequitur, a little loonier, and the world itself was a little bit loonier. It wasn't just animals in a town, it was animals underwater in a town. And and also, just the tone of the show was more about the jokes and less about the, you know, trying to tell a moral. Not that we had a lot of moral, there was lots of morality on Rocco, but Rocco was softer sometimes. But yet now, when you look at Rocco, it looks really harsh. There's actually things in it that you see that we couldn't do today. Rocco has a lot in it that's sort of like not on. You could do it now in Adult Swim, and that's why, you know, the Adult Swim type shows, Rocco feels more like one of those right now, like Ren and Stimpy can too. You know, mm-hmm. they're just a little bit harder edge, a little bit more mean spirited. You know, and then SpongeBob's character is to be so optimistic, he doesn't care. He rides over any negativity that's
sure.
how that that's
he goes
how
through a whole episode with the Tattletale Strangler trying to that's make right. plans to kill him.
That's right, and that's what I mean. That's what it was we found there was a like mindedness in the group that was there with Derek Dryman, and Steve, like I said, and we just felt the same way about comedy. We liked physical stuff a lot. We liked talking less, and we wanted to see stuff. So we were always trying to figure out how can we talk less in this episode and make sure we do a lot of stuff that's big and visual and fun. And so that became, you know, a sort of a mantra for the show. We were watching all the old Bugs Bunny stuff going, yeah, this is some of this stuff is just musical interludes.
Yeah.
You know, some of this stuff is so funny, and it's very specific kind of comedy. You know?
But Bugs Bunny was never stuck to a door in which someone opened the door, ripped off half his body, saw his beating heart, and then closed the door back.
Right, right,
and then he's back together.
Right, right.
I mean, it's very, very funny
stuff. Well, in the
Clampett
cartoons, you saw a little bit of that. Depending on who the director that was handling Tex Avery, you'd see stuff like that. But yeah, we kind of meshed together the stuff, the non sequitur Tex Avery type jokes where everyone gets blown apart, and then in the next scene they're back together.
Right.
They're fine. And except we tried to make it more like part of the narrative. You know, per se, you know, instead of doing just blackout jokes, we would, you know, we try to make it more story oriented. Whatever jokes we have kind of fits it. We're not just stopping for this one gag.
Sure.
it kind of fits the story.
But they do just come back together. Sure. Nobody has to go to make their face not the shape of the pie.
That's
pan.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
My ride's here.
Your ride's here.
So,
but you asked about Plankton. Yeah, Plankton. Really answer about that.
No, it's okay. Plankton was in early.
Yeah, Plankton was in the first season. You know, a couple times in the first season, and I think the plan originally was to have this be just another character on the show, and you know, just another guy that they deal with every so often, and maybe once a season we'll do a show with him, and that's how Steve sort of pitched the idea of it, and he originally had like a little man's face. That's the way Steve originally drew him. It was like a little man's face, which to me, nobody knows who this is, but it looked just like Michael Dukakis. It was like Michael Dukakis' face on this little bean with antennae. And I looked at it and we saw it, and he says, I don't know, maybe he talks kind of like Gregory Peck. And I had a voice, I used to do this sort of like homage to Thurl Ravenscroft. If anybody knows who that is, who did Tony the Tiger, he sang the Grinch song.
Hear me, one, Mr. Grinch. Mr. Grinch.
So I used to, so I did that, and usually on Rocco, because Carlos Ellis Rocky, our good buddy, and Tom Kenny, another good buddy of ours, were on that show with me. And I used to do that low pitch voice just to make Tom laugh. Tom would always laugh when I pull that voice out. So if I had an incidental character, I wouldn't say what I'm going to do. I'd do my regular voice for the incidental character. And then when I hit that point, I'd do it deliberately to make Tom laugh. And he'd spit and laugh and go, sorry, I'm sorry. And he just always loved that. So I actually auditioned. When he said, I got this Gregory Peck type voice, I said, yeah, okay, whatever. I wasn't thinking of it really until, you know, after that. So it wasn't like, hey, can you do a Gregory Peck voice? Yeah, I got it. I'll do this. Mm-hmm. Steve, after the show, when the pilot was being made, he said he had me come out and do audition for all the characters. I auditioned for Squidward. I auditioned for Mr. Krabs. I auditioned for Patrick.
And you were one of the guys, Bob. Man. You're right. In the inside group. It's you have to kind of...
Yeah, yeah.
Because they have to make it with Nick or with whatever producers and make everyone happy.
So they, for a second... And he said, he goes, I'll play this for them, but I'm not sure. I auditioned for SpongeBob with Plankton's voice.
Oh.
Not thinking it was Plankton necessarily.
Yeah.
I just auditioned for it, and I read all the lines on the pilot as Plankton. So it was, I'm ready. You know, it was that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Good morning, Gary. It was like that. And I did the whole thing, and it was everyone, I mean, loved it, laughed through the whole thing, going, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. It's so funny. And he says, that's such a bold choice idea. He says, I don't think it's probably not right, but it makes everyone laugh though. He says, you know, it was one of those things where the other voices were sort of like, oh yeah, that's kind of good. That's whatever. But everyone's laughing out loud when they heard my audition tape. So he just said, you know, I think it's probably Plankton. He says, cause that voice is so great. He says, I want to do it. And I did a tape for them. I did an audition tape for them. That was not for the network. It was just for me and them. That was filthy. It was just me saying the filthiest things with that voice that I could come up with. And I found out that when they got into their times when they were despairing, you know, making the pilot, which happens, you know, at some points where you just go, how are we going to get this done? Sure. What are we going to do? Steve said they would play my audition tape and start just crying, laughing at my, you know, it's how awful it all was. Because I really put on a show. I did like a half hour of some kind of stand-up, you know, hybrid with that voice. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when in the pilot, SpongeBob comes to the door and his voice changes for a moment when he gets up to the door of the Krusty Krab, and he says something like, I've been waiting for a long time to be part of the Krusty crew. All of a sudden his voice just changes into this superheroic sort of a voice. And that was Tom imitating me.
Oh,
So I got into the pilot sort of, you know, I was sort of in the pilot in spirit almost, you know, which I always thought was great whenever I heard that. And I said that to Tom one time. I said, that's so weird. He goes, oh, that's you. I was doing you. He said, I did it as a joke that I was imitating you because they were all laughing at your tape. And he says, and they used it. They said, no, that's funny. So Steve said to me, he goes, you'll be Plankton. I said, right. When the show goes to series, you know, like,
oh, hardy, har, like hardy, har, har, yeah.
Absolutely. I was like, yeah, that's okay. Great, you know. And then of course it happened, and I still, once it happened, even though they had all decided that I was doing this and this is what was happening, the show decided I was Plankton, but the studio hadn't decided yet. They were still like, we could stunt cast this, you know, we can have Bruce Willis do this voice. And Steve was just like, it's Doug. Don't you hear it? This is the character. This is the guy. Are you mad? You know, that's the way he was.
Well, now it just seems perfect.
Right.
And it just seems perfect that a little tiny green bean
would have that voice.
A character would have that voice.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and then on top of that fact, it was so, he was pushing and saying, Doug's one of us. He knows what we need. So I don't have to really tell him what to do. I don't have to, like, you know, push this guy too far. You know, he's already a cartoon guy. He knows what needs to be pushed and where it needs to go. So it worked perfect for the show. But I had to write material and go perform it down. So I had to write my own like audition stuff. So I wrote stuff for Plankton to say because I was writing the show. Went downstairs, recorded it, and then sent it to the network. Finally, they had to send out guys from New York, and we did a live pitch where I pitched. Where basically they put the boards up on the wall, which is how we pitch it to each other in the studio. And the guys who directed the episode that was called Plankton, the first episode, were doing it up on there. And whenever Plankton talked, I talked. And I just got, it was the huge reaction from everybody. You know, everyone laughed every time I spoke. And it was great. It was like one of those moments where I go, God, I've never done this well doing stand-up where everything you say works, because it's in this other voice. It's such a strange, weird, and it sounds funny. It's almost anything you say with him can sound silly.
And your voice doing Plankton probably was instrumental in developing that character into a megalomaniac.
Right, sure. Well, and in a way, and then also, it also fueled my own ambitions as a megalomaniac.
Yeah, personally, of
personally,
course, of course,
so that I could actually be in the show, writing the show,
right. And, so it was vitally important to you as a writer on the show
absolutely.
That Plankton be really funny,
right? Yeah, yeah,
and a great character,
and that
in
people
the show.
Want to keep bringing him back. And now he's a staple in the show. Now he's the fifth Beatle,
right?
But that's at first he was just a couple of shows in the first season, but then people really liked him, and adults really like him a lot because he's a more adult character. He actually represents a different kind of Bottom.
I think he's one of the Beatles, though. I don't think he's
Pitt. Really?
I don't think he's Pete Best. I don't think he's Billy Preston. I don't think he comes in occasionally on keyboards. I think he is one. I think he's Ringo.
I so wanted to be Billy Preston, but I think you're right. I think you're probably right. Now it's like he's got his own, the niche kind of worked, and I was able to write. I mean, early on, I was writing all of his episodes. I came up with all the ideas for pretty much his episodes because they would always, Steve would always go, well, let Doug worry about the Plankton shows because he understood that there was something about that character, that Wile E. Coyote style, bad guy, that I had in my head. Aside from, because he had a certain way in his head, and then I had a certain thing, like we all do. Then you have it. Tom's got SpongeBob slightly different way than Steve was thinking of SpongeBob, and things evolve.
Right.
Now you're collaborating. Now it's like you're both creating this character, and so that's what with me writing him and performing him, and being I guess the only person who really does that on the show. That became. A nice little signature for me. Now it's different. Now people can the character's so solidly formed. You know who he is, and I don't have to write all the shows that are played. We all, everybody writes the Plankton shows now. I try to write a bunch of them myself, and it's always for me is trying to push him further because I see him as Plankton's not only the megalomaniacal guy in town in Bikini Bottom who wants to take over the secret formula and the Krusty Krab, but he's a married man. He's a married
guy. I love his wife, Karen.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's my favorite thing. And Jill Talley, who plays, that's one of my favorite things to do on the show is knowing, aside from getting to work with people like you and Clancy Brown, is Jill, just that dynamic is so fun to me. And she loves it too. And we she's my other wife. We always look at each other as this other sort of, crazy marriage that we have, this on TV marriage, the whole world knows us as being married, and it's a funny, I don't know, it's always dynamic and funny, and I always enjoy the back and forth. We start to actually overlap so much talking to each other that they have to tell us, hey, stop doing that, separate what you're saying, because we start becoming
doing your relationship
couple.
Right,
we just start, it starts happening, that's what I love about him is that he has a heart. It's just really deep. It's really buried. underneath a lot of hurt and a lot of rejection and a lot of, you know, disappointment. And I can relate to that. We all can. Being in show business, you can relate to all that stuff. So I just pull that. That comes out with no problem whatsoever. Him being frustrated, him angry, him crying is so easy because I just think of my career.
And then at his very angriest, though, he's bound to be stepped on by someone.
Absolutely.
And scream even louder.
And scream even louder, yeah. Can't but really hurt himself.
But no, your career has gone very well.
Oh, yeah. But, we all relate to the rejection.
Oh, sure.
In our lives and in what we're doing, because we're looking for that, you know, that pat on the back from everybody, that some kind of admiration. We want to get a reaction from you, and we want you to be pleased on some level. We want some people to be pleased.
Yeah. And ultimately, Plankton would like the Krusty Krab recipe because possibly everyone would like him.
Would like him all of a sudden. Yeah. 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 Even though ultimately he probably would hate everybody for liking him eventually, mm-hmm. I think, because he'd be fed up eventually with that. Because he's so introverted at this point, you know, he's got his own little universe going on at the Chum Bucket. You know, he's got his computer wife and his, you know, his robots and things that, you know.
But so things have been going very well with you in SpongeBob.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the people who are listening, who are saying, "Man, he's got it made in the shade." what I have noticed about you in the
Sorry,
sessions that we would do, you know, we would have a session late afternoon or something.
Yeah, yeah,
and. Everyone else, I mean, I've done other things or other auditions, and I've come to a session. You were at Nick working very, very hard at storyboards and writing this out and everything, and then come to a session where Plankton is screaming his head off.
Right, that's right. And it's great.
I mean,
it's not that it's great, not my performance. I'm saying it's great that I get to do that.
Yeah. But for people who don't know Plankton, could you do it just a little Plankton anger, whatever thing? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I will not, sir. I will not do anything of the kind.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. But I just remember one session that we had where you came in. We did the whole session. You had worked all day.
Oh, that's right.
At your
that's
job.
Right.
You know, we did a long session. And at the very end of it, I was standing there, and they come on the intercom thing. Doug, listen, remember that session you did of all that lines where you're getting run over by a steamroller.
It was Imitation Krabs. I remember the episode.
It's just screaming pain and they said, all that stuff was damaged or
We lost it. No, they lost it.
Oh, they literally lost it.
The guy recorded it wrong. Because it wasn't a guy, it wasn't our normal guy who records, and he was a stand-in, and he didn't know what to do.
So it was a hard session.
So they got when you listen to the session, it sounded like there was reverb on it.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, they explained it to me later.
Had worked very hard and a full session.
You told me. You're the one who told me. I was at Salami Studios. I walked in the front door, and you looked at me, and you had this look of I'm so sorry, Doug. And I said, what? And he goes, did they tell you? And I said, no. He goes, that whole show we did last week is gone. And I said, no, what? And he goes, we have to do it again. You're the one who told me because everyone was off doing their
stuff.
Because,
man.
Because they had just told you and I walked in. I had no idea.
Because you do go to those sessions that you see, wow, that's a lot of screaming.
That's right.
That's a lot of.
Yeah. And so you were at both sessions with me.
I was at both. Right.
That's right.
So and you're just going, wow. And then we talk to the director, or the director tries to help us out and say, we'll save the screaming stuff until the end.
Right.
So we're going to skip those scenes and we'll do the other scenes.
That's right.
And then we'll get to the screaming where you might not have a voice for 3 days.
Absolutely.
But
that's
you're just going to go for it. And they just go, oh, you know what? We have to do that whole thing again.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I remember being a little scared. But you were even like, wow. Like, you were like, you're going to do that again?
Well, we did the session together, and it was, you know, it was a screamy one.
Yeah.
It was really hard.
It was great.
Where you have, or whatever, one of those, like, you know, in so many SpongeBobs, it ends up that I have some, whatever, an explosive full of nails explodes into my eyes. And I just have to go, eyes. And they're, you know, and you get one of those days where they're thinking, hey, Tom, it really didn't feel like there were nails.
You're really
getting
hurt.
It was feel like it's really like, okay, give me one.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and you're just screaming at the top of your lungs.
That's right. That's right.
And well, then to just have to do it again, it was pretty challenging.
It was. And it's, but it, you know what? That's one of my favorite things to do. That's one of the things I can do. My friend Martin Olson always says, you know, there's you can do that. He always said, he said, you're good at doing, he was talking to me, he said you're good at doing, you can go 0 to 60 in like 0.1 seconds. Mm-hmm. He said, in other words, I can go from being smiling and happy to flipping it to being completely exasperated, angry, screaming, and or in pain or whatever.
And like it that. Works.
And it works, yeah. And so, and it's just something I don't know what it is exactly, but it's something that, you know, I see other people who can do it too. It's just one of those things you can do. You either, you know, and it's something that that day when we had to do it again, at first I was sort of like miffed that I was going to have to do this again. But then when we did, it was actually turned out to be, you know, I was glad we did it because I think it was better. Like, I think when we were done, I was like, I think that was better than the first one we did. And both of us, it was something about it that all of a sudden became a richer performance because we had already done it. So it was like doing a stage play where you show up and it's like, oh, that was, you know, last week was good, but this week was really good. You were really good this time, you know. Which, you know, I hope that happens most of the time, but it's hard to judge yourself when you're doing that stuff. You know what I mean? Because you're doing many takes of it. You don't know which take they're going to use. You don't know what.
But ultimately, with that kind of stuff, you just have to trust directors and people. You just have to go like, look,
yeah.
I'm just throwing it out there, man. I'm doing my best.
Yeah, which I do. Which especially on this show, since we all know each other, we're all friends. We do trust each other. We do trust each other to say, yeah, you'll know which one's right. You know, you'll pick it out. And sometimes, you know, the right one that you think is the right one isn't right when you get into editing. So
right.
You know how that works. So
I don't really. Not as much as you.
Not as much as me. No. All right. Well, but still, you understand that there's those processes where you can stop for a moment and say, is this funny enough? Can we do this? There's before it goes out the door, you can look at it one more time if you care to, and you make it part of your schedule for your show. So a lot of people don't. They just do it and slap it together and they don't look at it again before it goes out, you know. So,
well, listen, can I do one more segment with you? Would that be all right?
Because
I'm not done. I'm not done talking to you.
No. You can do whatever you want because it's for you. Today's for you. I'm here for you. So it's whatever you want to do.
Makes me uncomfortable because I was here for you. Now I don't know what to do.
We could have done this in your guest house.
What if an emergency? No, we could have. Let's move there now and just do the second.
The next segment at your
Mr. Lawrence. Your thanks. Thanks so much, everybody, for downloading the podcast. Thank you for your comments. Consider subscribing if you haven't, or consider telling a friend. And I appreciate it so much. Thanks to Chris and Katie over at Nerdist. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for always helping me out. But most of all, as always, thanks to you. I've been amazed at the reaction to the podcast. People are coming out to live shows and telling me, hey, I'm really enjoying myself listening to the podcast. So, hey, thanks, guys, and we'll see you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.